This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we explore what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Darshan Johan, and previously on the show, we asked the question, what if Malaysia has a woman prime minister? Today, we'll be exploring what if Malaysia decriminalized all drugs for personal use. Joining me on the show today is Samantha Chong, a lawyer with a passion for drug policy reforms. Welcome to the show, Samantha.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, Samantha, perhaps you can start by giving us an overview of what the drug laws in Malaysia are like right now.
So basically, there are about 5 pieces of drug-related laws in Malaysia. So I'll discuss at least 2 of it. So the first is the well-known Dangerous Drug Act 1952. Is a piece of legislation enacted in the 50s that criminalized drug trafficking, manufacturing, use, possessions of dangerous drugs. So in the first schedule, it also defined what dangerous drugs is and specified the legal procedure for drug cases. And the second one we have is the Drug Treatments and Rehabilitations Act 1983. It is a law that provides for the treatments and rehabilitations of people who are depending on drugs. And the third one, we have the National Anti-Drugs Agency 2004. It basically established a national anti-drug agency to deal with the treatments, rehabilitations, enforcement, investigations of drug offences. One key note of the law is that the treatments and rehabilitations of drug dependents is actually within the jurisdictions of the Home Ministry and not the Health Ministry.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but in Malaysia, it's a crime to even carry and use even the smallest amount of drugs, even if these drugs are what many other countries may consider recreational drugs.
Yes, you're right. There's no difference between recreational drugs or drugs using for self-medicating or so. Under the Dangerous Drug Act 1952, basically, there are 2 types of possessions. One is I will call the low-level possessions. It can be punishable by a fine or imprisonment not more than 5 years. And the other one is the possessions that carry increased penalty. So, for example, if you carry 20 grams of cannabis but less than 50 grams, you can be jailed for minimum 2 years but not exceeding 5 years and be liable for 3 strokes. And if you have 50 grand and above, the minimum sentence is 5 years and 10 strokes. But say, if you carry more than 200 grams, you can be presumed to be in trafficking and the sentence can be death sentence.
But what exactly is the idea or goal behind these laws when they are implemented, or even when we look at the war on drugs on a global scale, what exactly is the purpose or goal behind this?
So the idea behind war on drugs was actually prohibition-based international drug control systems. And the idea is very simple. If you don't have drugs, it's a drug-free world, then there's no people that will be dependent or addicted to drugs. So it is led by the US federal government in the 70s, and countries were pressured into signing this international law convention. So if you look at Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia's, Malaysia's law, our drug laws are pretty similar because it is the product of this international drug convention. So as to why we have this zero-tolerance drug policy, it has a lot of things to do with political problem. So why US in the 70s actually pushed for this prohibition-based international drug control is because back then in the 70s, they are facing a lot of internal issues. For example, economy crisis associated with Vietnam War, the uprising of youth power, hippies. And this prohibition-based concept actually didn't focus on the demand or the harm associated with drugs. They focus more on stopping drug-producing countries into stem the flow of drugs into this Western powers' territory. So it basically, if you sign the international drug conventions, you need to stop drugs from flowing out. The zero tolerance drug policy has very little to do with the negative effect on the risk of particular substance. It has to do mainly with who is using these drugs and who are associating with these drugs. So in the US in the 70s, cannabis is associated with the hippies and heroin is associated with the blacks. So as a government, you have two options. One is to give them treatments. One, perhaps, is to arrest them, incarcerate them. And the government, the US government back then, has clearly opted for an approach that disrupts the communities. And I believe all this are more political motivated than actually scientific based.
But has the war on drugs actually been successful globally?
Despite 40 years of zero tolerance global drug campaign, you will still see that drug remain a problem now. You can look at AADK's statistics. Mm-hmm. We can see the arrests of people who use drugs has increased steadily. And we need to understand that the global drug market is one of the primary revenue source for organized crime. And illicit drugs industry now accounts for estimate about $320 billion annually, second behind counterfeit products. So the drug markets cannot just exist on their own, mm-hmm. but it has to tie down with the cartel, the corruptions of government officers, warlords in certain countries that use drugs to fund their activities. It is not a simple issue that when you arrest the people who bring in drugs, you will stop drug problems. Because we, in drug policy, we have something called balloon effect. So when policymakers and law enforcement crack down on certain drug production country or certain area, these syndicates and cartels, they just move to another area. For example, from Afghanistan to the Golden Triangle. So when you are hard on Golden Triangle, they move back to Afghanistan. It doesn't stop the drug supplier because it is not a comprehensive strategy to deal with drug issues. Of course, they say if you stop the supply, you won't have demand. But the thing is, if you do nothing on the demand, we will never solve these issues. Looking back to the pattern in Malaysia, what is the effect of war on drugs in Malaysia? So as at December 2019, 25 out of 38 prisons in this country are overpopulated. And our capacity is 52,850. And now we have, in December 2019, we have 74,000.
Right.
So in 2017, 56% of the inmates in the prisons incarcerated because of non-violent drug-related offense. I'm not talking about drug trafficking, but drug use and low-level possessions. And in 2018, 164,914 people were arrested for drug-related offenses. And looking back at in the context of COVID-19, we have the latest statistic. So 53,357 inmates was tested and 16,662 are positive. So if you have overpopulated prisons, you will tend to have infectious diseases spreading among the inmates to the warden, from the warden to their families and into the communities. So when we talk about war on drugs, we are talking about public health as well. And I would say war on drugs in Malaysia has caused us a lot in terms of people losing their job because of criminal records and people who end up having infectious diseases, for example, latent TB and COVID-19.
And who ends up suffering the most? You brought up earlier this idea of, you know, disruption of communities, how in, you know, in America, a lot of times the African-American community gets targeted. What about here in Malaysia? Who ends up suffering the most during the war on drugs?
The war on drugs in Malaysia, the casualties, the victims are mostly families that come from lower income groups. Mm-hmm. So if you can afford to pay the fine, you won't end up in the prison. And from my experience, law enforcement agency tends to have a different approach when dealing with poorer society and a more well-off society. When it comes to a low-cost apartment, normally they will not hesitate to knock on the door in the middle of night and just arrest them. We see it on and off in the newspaper. And my experience in courts, I always see the poorest people end up in the prison. Mm-hmm. When I went to Sungai Buloh prison to visit a client, I saw a family, two women and four children. The youngest child is just 2 years old, and they were walking from the main the Sungai Buloh Visitor Center, Sungai Buloh Prison Visitor Center, to the main gate. It's about 1 kilometer. So I stopped my car and give them a lift. So it is from there she told me the story that her husband was arrested for drug use, and he wanted to plead guilty. He couldn't because the chemist report is still pending. And they lost their only breadwinner. But still, the family continue to visit him, to try to give him the support that they can. They are not alone in this system. There are many more poor people that are suffering from this. So for the same person, for example, if the accused, he was arrested and he has money, he could have just paid a bail money and get out from the system. He don't need to be remanded in the prison pending for his case to be disposed. So we see that prohibition approach on drugs actually hit the hardest on the poorest communities and continue to make them more marginalized. Addiction is a medical problem that need medical intervention. So prison departments, they are not trained to deal with medical issues, and they do not have the expertise or resources to deal with it. So 60% of 70,000 people, inmates that were incarcerated for using drugs, it is expected that 90% of them will relapse and use drugs again. And a part of that, once you are incarcerated, you will carry a criminal record. So that will mean that a proper and stable employment is almost impossible. And we all know that without stable incomes, people can be drawn to depressions, to anxiety, and this will push them closer to drug use as a form to escape from the emotional pain they are facing. So I would say that incarcerations actually has created more problems when we deal with drugs issues.
All right. On that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. After the break, we will be exploring if decriminalizing all drugs for personal use could be a solution to the problems we've just discussed. We'll be back with more on What If Malaysia, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the second episode of What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we examine what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Darshan Johan, and with me on the show is Samantha Chong, a lawyer with a passion for drug policy reforms. And what we're doing is we are exploring what if Malaysia decriminalized all drugs for personal use. So Samantha, we've established that the war on drugs has pretty much been an epic disaster that not only failed to stop drug trafficking over the years and cut out the supply, but also contributed to a whole host of other problems. I guess now the question is, what can we do about it? What if we changed our perspective altogether? So I was reading up the other day on how Portugal was suffering from a drug problem in the 70s, 80s and 90s. It was pretty much an epidemic, right? And then the government decided to take a radical approach to combat this problem by decriminalizing all drugs for personal use. And it worked. It sounds crazy, right? So perhaps you can explain Portugal's approach.
So before Portugal decriminalized drug use, our situations were pretty much similar. Half of the people in the prisons were there for drug-related reasons, and of course, like what you say, the overdose epidemic. And Portugal's policy basically have three pillars. One, there's no such thing as soft and hard drugs. It's only the health aspect with drugs. And the second is drug use has it's not a moral issue, but it has a lot of other underlying problems. For example, their relationship with their loved one and with and the world around them and with themselves, that why people use drugs. And the third pillar is that drug-free world is an impossible goal. So that is a Portugal policy. And what Portugal police will do if they come across a person who use drugs or who are in possession of drug use? So instead of being arrested, they will be referred to a committee called the Dissuasive Committees. So this committee consists of three experts. One, a medical practitioner. Second, a social welfare officer. And the third, a lawyer. So these committees will then decide if this person needs treatment or just need a counseling session. Because we have to understand here, not everybody who uses drugs equal to people who are dependent on drugs. Some are just using drugs on a weekend basis. They do not need medical treatments, but they need counseling sessions as to why they are using drugs and what are the harm that might cause if they use drugs in a very dangerous way. Then, with the shift of drug policy, more people are actually on treatment in Portugal. Many expect that drug use will go up, but instead of that, they see a significant reduction in problematic drug use and overdose death because more and more people are actually referred to evidence-based treatment. And so it is not just decriminalizations in Portugal, they actually make drug-dependent treatment more accessible to those who need it.
There is a lot of stigma surrounding drug use in Malaysia, in all over the world, but what are the consequences of this stigma?
The stigma attached with drug use is that using drugs is a moral issue, that people who use drugs are moral vampire. They are the feces of the society. In Malay, we call Nazis negara. So the consequences of the stigma is that people who need treatments, they don't get the treatment they need because of fear of being registered as a criminal. Addictions is a medical issue, but the stigmatizations of the society see these people as criminal that cannot be trusted. And this actually doesn't help people who have dependent problems to break out from their addiction cycle. And when they have served their time, they came out from the prison. They wanted to start a new life, turn over a new leaf. But the distrust of the society remains. And so we often see these people who were sentenced to prison again and again in the court for similar offences. The judge and the lawyers and the police will say, can you just insafla, just repent, change? But addiction itself means the inability to stop. Stigmas in society is that once you use drugs, you will be addicted to drugs and your future is gone. But that is not the case. If you look at the scientific evidence, there was research published in a medical journal like Lancet that assess the different risks associated with certain drugs. They found that alcohol is a lot more dangerous than cannabis. But why alcohol is only regulated, but cannabis is outlawed? Mm-hmm. So, and cannabis is proven to have medicinal potential in terms of the treating of epilepsy, of chronic pain, and other diseases. So, but these stigmatizations not only deter people from getting the help that they need, but also the scientific research that we can have with cannabis and other drugs can be a potential cure for certain diseases. And when I talk about decriminalization, it doesn't mean that we are legalizing drugs. It doesn't mean that you can now openly have cannabis in the mamak store or restaurant or whatsoever. Decriminalizations mean the removal of criminal penalties, and drug trafficking remains as an offense.
We know that this has been a effective method in countries like Portugal, for example, where, you know, after they took this so-called radical approach, drug-induced death rate has plummeted to 5 times lower than in the EU, and it stands also 1/50th of the United States. So, but do you think the environment and culture in Malaysia would allow such an approach?
In Portugal, actually, a public health approach is adopted. To say it is radical, in the eyes of law enforcement, yes, maybe it's radical. But from the angle of a doctor and scientist, it is not, because it is very much scientific-based. So if addiction is a medical problem, then why referring these people to treatments is radical? And whether Malaysia is ready, I would say actually we have done it before. In 2006, Malaysia's government has introduced methadone treatments for those who are addicted to heroin. So the police stopped arresting them in the methadone treatment site. Instead of sending them to prisons, they were referred to the clinic Cure and Care to receive their treatment. And back then, we see a sharp reduce of repeated drug user being arrested. Are we ready? I say we are ready, because you can go and ask people on the street, do you think people who are addicted to drugs need treatment? They will say yes. And then the second reason, do you think prison department is equipped and well-resourced to treat addiction? They will say no. The third question you can ask them, then should we refer these people to doctors who are trained to deal with addictions? They will say yes. So I think it is very much depending on how you package it. Hmm. If you use the big word decriminalizations, you will scare 80% of people. They will say, are you mad? We are not going to legalize drugs. But when you say, what if we divert these people from criminal justice systems to health sector? They will say yes. So I think we have done it before and we are ready for this.
You brought up the methadone treatment, which is interesting, and it resembles an approach that countries like Portugal and even Switzerland take, right? In Switzerland, for example, they actually provide heroin and cocaine addicts with what they need for safer consumption, which is clean needles, tin foil, and psychological support. This is what the government provides addicts, which again can seem like a mind-blowing concept to people who are not familiar. But you brought up that Malaysia already has the methadone treatment, for example. Why doesn't it get the kind of awareness? And if there are these sorts of treatment available, then why are some people going to prison? Why is there a lot of confusion and lack of awareness?
First, in Portugal and Switzerland, people who use drugs were provided with clean needle. It's not because the government want to encourage them to use drugs, mm-hmm. but it has very much to do with the HIV epidemic back then. Because people who inject drugs, if they share needle, they will spread HIV faster. So this is what we call harm reductions approach. We try to reduce the harm associated with certain risky behavior. And in Malaysia, we have this needle exchange syringe program as well to reduce the HIV prevalence among people who use drugs. And we have seen a great success in reducing the numbers of HIV new cases among people who inject drugs. As to why we don't have this awareness in Malaysia, because drug use is still heavily stigmatized in Malaysia. The NGOs, the communities-based organizations, they are doing a lot of awareness program among with the communities who use drugs. But if you publicize the needle exchange syringe program, because we are still a conservative country,
right.
People will think that, come on, you are encouraging drug use. But actually, they are not. They are just merely trying to reduce the prevalence of HIV among people who inject drugs. As to methadone treatments, methadone is only workable for heroin cases. It doesn't work with meth and others. And when you ask why people are still arrested for drugs and sent to prison when we have methadone treatments and NSEP, people are still arrested because of our law that is punitive in nature. Any use of drugs is illegal. And methadone treatments, NSEP, they are policy decisions. Our decriminalizations, our type of decriminalizations that we don't arrest people but we refer them to methadone clinic is just policy. So if an ADK or a police narcotic chief change, they can always decide to arrest the people who use drugs because it is still within the law. So it is kind of contradictory.
Okay, Samantha, let's just imagine for a second that Malaysia actually decriminalized all drugs for personal use. What would our country look like? How will it be different from our state of affairs right now?
I would say that is not enough because drug issues is a very complicated issues. Not only we need to decriminalize drugs for personal use, we need to change our law. We need to make drug-dependent treatments more accessible. We need to educate society, the communities, and we need to destigmatize drug use, that it is not a moral issue. It is a medical issue that need treatments, evidence-based treatments. And in terms of education, we need to also review our drug prevention campaign. Just Say No campaign is failing. Because for a lot of people who end up having problematic drug use, they have other underlying problems. For example, depressions, mental health issues, past abuse traumas, and self-medicating for physical pain. Of course, if you incarcerate people, that will be the simplest solutions. But drug issues is a lot more complicated than that. And if we decriminalize personal drug use, it will be the first major step into an evidence-based public health approach drug policy. If we change our drug policy, we will see at least a 50% reductions in terms of prison populations. We will see that it's a reduced risk for people who get infectious diseases when they are incarcerated. And the government can save a lot of money in terms of incarceration. So this money can be channeled into drug prevention programs and drug treatments. We have heard many stories about people, famous people who use drugs. For example, a few US presidents, they have used drugs in their younger days. And if these people are thrown into prison and carry a criminal record, they won't be the US presidents they were, or they won't be the richest person in the world. So there was this story I read a newspaper. A boy, he scored 7 A's in his XPM results. And he was sentenced to 1 year because of his drug use in prison. And a further interview revealed that his sister and his father were also incarcerated because of non-violent drug offences. So we can see here a war on drug approach. It's not just on drugs, but it is actually a war on family institutions. And if we look back at the cost effectiveness of war on drugs, government pay about 42 ringgit for an upkeeping of each prisoners. So it will be, the cost of imprisonment is about 20,000 a year for prison and 38,000 for the compulsory drug rehabilitation center, when the cost for voluntary and community treatments is just 6,500 ringgit. So, and research has shown that voluntary community-based treatments is far more effective than the compulsory drug rehabilitation center. And if we decriminalize drug use again, we will clear the backlog of court cases. Currently, the lower courts, they have about 60-70% at least non-violent drug-related cases. We can also relieve the burden of our police, our law enforcement agency. They can now focus on a much more serious crime like housebreaking, robbery, murder, drug trafficker, instead of focusing on the victim of addiction. So it will be very different from today, and it is a step that I think we must take for our people and for our loved ones. let's face this, drug problem is real and serious in Malaysia. In our life, we all know somebody that is struggling with drugs addiction. And we don't know where to send them. Do we send them to a private rehab? Do we refer them to police, to ADK? But on the other hand, we are worried that they may have criminal records and that will destroy their future. So if we have changed our drug policy, not only we are helping people who struggle with drug problem, we are actually helping their family as well, the communities around them. Because drug doesn't affect just individual, but it's a package. It destroys the family institutions if we continue to have punitive drug policy. I would say that punitive drug policy actually does more harm than the substance itself.
Samantha, on the flip side, there are some studies that show that more people have experimented with drugs in Portugal since 2001, and this is because of their approach, which is decriminalization. Do you see this happening in Malaysia too if we follow this method? And also, does it actually matter if, in fact, there are more people who start experimenting with drugs because of this shift in approach? Should that be a factor when deciding if the consumption of drugs should be criminalized in the first place?
Okay, why we want to decriminalize drug use? Because we want more people to get treatment. And for experimental user, they might not need treatment at all. So I don't think that it should be a factor in deciding what kind of drug policy that we are having and whether we should decriminalize drug use. And many people will think that drug use will go up, the drug price will go down if we decriminalize drug use. We don't see that in countries that decriminalize drug use and possession for personal use. I think when we need to review drug policy, it cannot be based on perception, but it must be based on scientific and research and studies. So studies from countries that have decriminalized drug use show that decriminalization works. And if you look in Malaysia, let's admit it, drug is easily available. Even during MCO, drugs can be used. Door to door by the drug syndicates. But on the other hand, our drug dependent treatments is not so flexible. On and off, I get calls and message. Where do I send my nieces, my nephew, my son, my daughter who have drug dependent issues? I don't really have a good answer than saying you can send them to the hospital. Because you send them to the police and ADK, they can be detained 2 years in the compulsory center. They can carry a criminal record. So I think these are the things that we need to consider when we review our drug policy. The negative implications of war on drug on these people, and not too much focus on experimental users who clearly do not need addiction treatments. So I think there should be a clear distinction between these two. I think we are ready for this. We just need more education.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Samantha.
Thank you for having me.
That was Samantha Chong, a lawyer with a passion for drug policy reforms, answering the question, what if Malaysia decriminalized all drugs for personal use? And that wraps up our second episode of What If Malaysia, an 8-episode mini-series where we explore what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. So if you missed any part of this conversation or the first episode of the series, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, BFM.my, or you can even subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. You just have to look for BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and you've been listening to What If Malaysia on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to BFM.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.